For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
All right, well, we're going to actually wrap up Genesis tonight, and we've got 14 chapters to cover. Yeah, and we're going to actually cover quite a bit. Don't laugh too soon. I'm serious. We're going to actually get into quite a bit of this. And so let's do that. Let's dive right in. Last week's teaching focused on Abraham's grandson Esau. This week we're going to shift our focus to his other grandson Jacob, to Jacob's 12 sons, and to a specific son. This is the guy we're going to really focus on, Joseph, one of Jacob's 12 sons. So most of this teaching, I'm just going to tell you Joseph's story. Now, I don't use the word story because this is fiction, like, you know, a campfire story or something like that. But I do think the word story is appropriate because this story is every bit as good as any movie script that you've ever read or watched. There is all the key elements of story: drama, tension, climax, resolution. It's all in this. If all we cared about literature was literature, this is a masterpiece. And so I thought, well, maybe I'd summarize this, but it's too good to do that with. We're going to read a good chunk of it, and I'll do my best to keep it interesting, but I think I'd be robbing you if we didn't look at the story. So we're going to do that, and then at the end, and really all the way through, there are some powerful lessons. I hope they really come out as we go through this. So that's the game plan. His story, all 14 chapters worth. We'll skip a few, don't worry. And then some lessons that come from it. Let's dive in. All right, so Jacob settled again in the land of Canaan. This is pretty much synonymous with the promised land, the land of Israel. So he settles there where his father had lived. And when Joseph was 17 years old, again, Joseph is one of his 12 sons. So when he was a teenager, he often would tend his father's flocks. He worked for his half-brothers. He had 10 older brothers, one younger brother. But one day Joseph reported to his father some of the bad things that his brothers were doing. And so right here, this is the first shot across the bow. Joseph does something that really pisses his brothers off. And here we have the beginning of something that runs all the way through. And that is deep tension, strife between Joseph and his brothers. Tension that really builds and builds as we go through this. Another source of tension was that Jacob loved Joseph more than any of his other children, because Joseph had been born to him in his old age. So, you know, the favorite. That was another. It was galling for the brothers. They knew that Jacob loved Joseph the best. And then in addition, one day Jacob had a special gift made just for Joseph, a beautiful robe. So he's parading around in this symbol of favoritism, which is why you read his brothers hated him. They hated him because their father loved Joseph more than the rest of them. They couldn't say a kind word to him. So this is kind of a slow building resentment that just gets deeper and deeper as we go through. One night, and this makes it even worse, Joseph had a dream. And when he told his brothers about it, they hated him even more than ever. "Listen to this dream," he said. "We were out in the field tying up bundles of grain. Suddenly, my bundle stood up and your bundles all gathered around and bowed low before mine." Yeah, it's just a provocative dream to have, especially from a teenager. His brothers responded, "So you think you're going to be our king? Do you actually think you're going to reign over us?" They're like, "Dude, come on." Well, and it says, and this is the third time in 5 verses, it says they hated him all the more because of his dreams and the way he talked about them. And I don't know if you've ever hated someone, but it has its own momentum. There's something It feels good to hate sometimes, and it builds, and it can just like build like a wave crashing on the beach, and it's just surging as we keep reading this. Soon Joseph had another dream, and again he told his brothers about it, and this is like gas on the fire. "Listen, I've had another dream," he said. "The sun, the moon, and 11 stars bowed low before me." Now, who are the sun, moon, and 11 stars? That would be mom, dad, and his 11 brothers. There's a kid's book I used to read to my kids that depicts this. There's Joseph in his special outfit. And it just makes him look like a little egomaniac. Just, creation bowing before me. So, you know, his brothers are seeing red at this point. And then this is the dagger. As Jacob says to Joseph, "You know, your brothers are pasturing the sheep at Shechem. So get ready and I'll send you to them." And Joseph eagerly says, "I'm ready to go." And so what does he get? What is he there to do? He's being deputized by his dad to go check up on his brothers and make sure they're not screwing up. And so when Joseph's brothers see him coming, they recognized him and in the distance. And as he approached, they made plans to kill him, kill his brother. It says, they say, "Here they come," or "Here comes the dreamer," they said. "Come on, let's kill him and let's throw him into one of these cisterns. We can tell our father a wild animal has eaten him, and then we'll see what becomes of his dreams." They're not proposing to just initially throw him away somewhere and leave. They're talking about killing him in cold blood. I don't know if that's stabbing him to death or if it's like pelting him with rocks till he stops moving, but they were going to murder him and then dispose of his body. That's how insanely filled with hate they were. Well, it says Reuben came to Joseph's rescue. He's the firstborn. He says, "Let's not kill him. Why should we shed any blood? Let's just throw him into this empty cistern." Apparently, these things are really hard to climb out of, these collecting water. And it says, let's throw him here in the wilderness, and he'll die without our laying a hand on him. And so that's what they do. They actually pitch him into some big stone retaining thing for holding water. And it says when Joseph arrived, when he finally shows up, they strip him of that beautiful robe, they grab him, and they throw him into this cistern. And we know from another passage, we know that when they did this, he cried and pleaded and shouted and begged for his life. And they walked away. So they just heard him shouting, and the shout got fainter. And then they sat down and had a meal. It says, then just as they were sitting down to eat, they looked up and saw a caravan of camels in the distance coming toward them. It was a group of Ishmaelite traders taking a load of gum, balm, and aromatic resin from Gilead down to Egypt. And so they realize at this point, there's an opportunity. Back then, the selling price for a slave, and we know this from this text here, and also from archaeology, it was 20 shekels of silver, which was a fair amount of money. It was like a year's wage for a daily worker. And they're like, why don't we cash in on this instead of just letting him rot? And so Judah said to his brothers, what are we going to gain by killing our brother? We'd have to cover up the crime. Instead of hurting him, let's sell him to those Ishmaelite traders. After all, he's our brother and our own flesh and blood. And his brothers agreed with this. So they all of them agree. That's a good idea. Let's sell our own brother as a slave to somebody we've never met before. And so the brothers kill a young goat, and they dip Joseph's robe in its blood. The one piece they still have to figure out is what they're going to tell their father. And so what their plan is to fake it so it looks like he was killed by a wild animal. So they take his robe, dip it in blood. They sent the beautiful robe to their father with this message. Look at what we found. Doesn't this robe belong to your son? Your son. Not our brother. Yeah, just in their own word choice betrays their hard attitude. And then Jacob gets the news that, you know, this is every parent's worst nightmare. Losing a child. Their father recognized the robe. He's like, yes, it is my son's robe. A wild animal must have eaten him. Joseph's clearly been torn to pieces. And so assuming his son is dead, you know, Jacob is completely despondent, as we see that. And so here what we're running into is the first ripple effect of this crime. Their father's life is torn apart. We're going to see Joseph's life torn apart. We're going to see their own lives ripped apart by this decision, this tension that they had with their brother that fueled the hatred that led to this murderous rage and this insane idea of selling him into slavery. That's how this story sets up, with this tremendous tension in this family. Well, Jacob tore his clothes and he dressed himself in burlap and he mourned deeply for his son for a long time. And then the scene shifts. It says that when Joseph was taken to Egypt by the Ishmaelite traders, he was purchased by Potiphar. That's the guy on the right there, an Egyptian officer. Potiphar was captain of the guard for Pharaoh, the king of Egypt. So he makes it all the way down to Egypt, comes into the possession of a wealthy nobleman, Potiphar. And here, for the first time in the story, we hear about the Lord. I haven't heard the Lord mentioned yet. And what we hear is that the Lord was with Joseph so that he succeeded in everything that he did as he served in the home of his Egyptian master. So along with the tension in this family, there's a huge theme, you can't miss it, that God is present with Joseph every step of the way through this ordeal. You see it again if you go up into this next passage here. It says that Potiphar noticed this and realized that the Lord was with Joseph, giving him success in everything he did. So it was so striking that even Potiphar, who doesn't believe in the God of Israel, he notices there's something special happening here. Now, it pleased Potiphar, so he soon made Joseph his personal attendant. He put him in charge of his entire household and everything that he owned. So it was just so obvious that God's blessing Joseph, that he's a capable person. Potiphar's like, run the whole show. Now, what is it when we talk about God being present in this story? What is God present and focused on? Well, we go all the way back to these promises. God had made a promise to take the descendants of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and grow them into a great nation. And Joseph had a key role in that promise. And all the way through this story, even though Joseph can't see it, he's locked in time. He can't see what God's up to. He's got like glimpses. He can sense that God is with him, but he can't see the big picture. We can. And the big picture is that God is using Joseph to honor his promise to protect his people and grow them into a great nation. And so we keep reading that the Lord was with Joseph. He was very handsome here, well-built young man. And it says that Potiphar's wife soon began to look at him lustfully. Now, I don't know what he looked like. I grabbed this picture off the internet. She's real subtle in her approach. She's like, come and sleep with me, she demanded. Now, he's wearing kind of a towel skirt. If you look at Egyptian artwork, it seems like they like to wear these towels, which kind of doubled as shorts. And so, yeah, he's walking around. She's like, I've got to get into this Hebrew dude somehow. Demands to have sex with him. Joseph refuses. He says, look, my master trusts me with everything in his entire household. Nobody here has more authority than I do. He's held back nothing from me except for you because you're his wife. How could I do this wicked thing? And then here's the question. You got to wonder, you know, Joseph was betrayed by a family of people that believed in God, supposedly, right? And now he's stuck as a slave in this household. He's being hit on by somebody who's probably very attractive. And this is one of those times where we get to see, so the Lord's with Joseph, but is he with the Lord? Or has he decided to kind of get dark-hearted about everything that's happened and just be like, well, screw it. You know, the people that follow God totally rejected me. And what we find out is that he is with the Lord. He says no to this woman because he realizes it's a great sin against God. He still wants to follow God, even though he's been through all this. Well, she keeps putting pressure on Joseph day after day, but he refuses to sleep with her. She tries to wear him down. You know, he's young. She's probably attractive. Definitely an opportunity here to take a bad turn. And yet it says he kept out of her way as much as possible. One day, however, no one else was around when he went in to do his work. She came in and grabbed him by his cloak and demanded, come on, sleep with me. And Joseph tore himself away, but he left his cloak in her hand as she ran from the house. So she literally rips his towel skirt off his body, and he streaks naked out of the house. That's what happens. The first biblical streaker, I think, in Genesis. So, yeah, that's an awkward moment. And at this point, what are her options? It's not like trying again tomorrow. It's obviously he's not into it. What happens is she falsely accuses Joseph of trying to rape her. She tells her husband about it. Potiphar gets super upset, throws Joseph into jail. And so he's imprisoned by the Egyptians. We read, the Lord was with him in the prison. There it is again. And showed him his faithful love. The Lord made Joseph a favorite with the prison warden. Before long, the warden put Joseph in charge of all the other prisoners and over everything that happened in the prison. The warden had no more worries, just like Potiphar, because Joseph took care of everything. The Lord was with him and caused everything he did to succeed. So like a drumbeat, like we saw in the beginning of the same chapter, the Lord, the Lord, the Lord, every step of the way, sustaining Joseph, helping him through this dark period while he's thrown into jail. And not just here, but again, just chapter after chapter, the same message. God actively working his purposes, even in adversity, in Joseph's life. Here's another example. Sometime later, Pharaoh's chief cupbearer, that's the guy that sips the king's wine to make sure it's not poisonous. So the cupbearer and the chief baker offended their royal master. Pharaoh became angry with these two officials, and he put them in the prison where Joseph was, in the palace of the captain guard. Okay, so these two guys come and they join Joseph in jail, the baker and the cupbearer. And they remain there for a while. So this is how we get some kind of chronology. Joseph was in jail a long time, maybe as long as a decade when you add it all up. So they're with him in prison. The captain of the guard assigns them to Joseph, who looks after them. And while these two officials are in prison, Pharaoh's cupbearer and the baker each have a dream. And each dream has its own meaning. So these guys, they have these really vivid dreams. They tell Joseph about them. And the dream interpretations are really bad and really good. The baker tells his dream to Joseph, and Joseph says, you want to know what it means? It means you're going to be executed in 3 days. And then he tells the cupbearer the interpretation of his dream. And this is it. He tells the guy, within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift you up and restore you to your position as his chief cupbearer. And please remember me and do me a favor when things go well for you. Mention me to Pharaoh so that he might let me out of this place. And so amazingly, but like we're going to see all the way through, God actually revealed the true meaning. This is another way God is involved, of these dreams. And just like Joseph said, this cupbearer was restored to his position. The problem is, the cupbearer forgot all about Joseph, and he never gave him another thought. You know, Joseph was sitting there thinking, you know, the day after the cupbearer goes back to the Pharaoh, he's like, well, maybe I'll get a call from Pharaoh. And then the day became a week, and the week became a month, and the month became a year, and then 2 years. If you read the beginning of the next chapter, it says 2 full years of waiting in silence, nothing. No response from the cupbearer, no indication of any change. This had to be a low point for Joseph after everything that he'd been through, just left in squalor and forgotten. 2 more years of languishing. And you know, as this story unfolds, his life is slipping through his fingers. He started out as a 17-year-old. Now he's 30. His youth is over. He's stuck, you know, in other people's hands until he's age 30. I don't know about you. There's been stretches where I've felt really set aside. I can think at times as a leader or a teacher, just somebody who wants to serve God. I felt set aside and forgotten, felt like there was no way forward. Maybe you can think of stretches where you just felt like, you know, nobody has any kind of vision for you, that any the days of ever having any kind of impact or in the past, it would have been super easy for him to just curve inward and just be like, where, you know, why is it that everybody in my life is screwing me over? And God, where have you been? I tried to do the right thing with Potiphar's wife, and look at what it got me. Look at the reward. Just being forgotten in this situation. It would have been super easy to just flip a switch and be done with God at this point. Easily. And yet, at this very moment, this is probably the worst moment in Joseph's life, we still see God powerfully at work. It says, 2 full years later, after being forgotten, Pharaoh dreamed that he was standing on the bank of the Nile River. So Pharaoh has a really vivid dream. He sees these cows. It's a weird dream, too, a very bizarre dream. In his dream, he sees these 7 fat, healthy cows coming up out of the river and beginning to graze on the marsh grass. Then he sees 7 more cows coming up behind them from the Nile. But these were scrawny and thin, and these cows stood beside the fat cows on the riverbank. Then the scrawny, thin cows, these gaunt, you know, you can see their rib cages. They ate the 7 healthy fat cows, and at this point in the dream, Pharaoh woke up. So how weird, you got these scrawny, cannibalistic cows eating the other cows. Pharaoh's really puzzled by this. He has a second dream about 7 heads of grain, very similar pattern. And he's talking about this out loud. He's like, yeah, I had this dream, and then I had another one. I just don't know what to think about this. And the cupbearer, who had his own dream interpreted accurately, overhears Pharaoh speaking. And it says, finally, the king's chief cupbearer, you're not really supposed to speak. So this is kind of a gutsy move. He speaks up, and he says, today I've been reminded of my failure, he told Pharaoh. And so he goes on to tell him, you know, I know a Hebrew that I was a cellmate with back in prison. And when we were hanging out together, he accurately interpreted these 2 different dreams. He was like dead on the money. And Pharaoh is so intrigued. He's like, okay, well, go get him. I want to hear what he has to say. And so they dig Pharaoh out of jail. Pharaoh sent for Joseph, or they dig Joseph out. They sent for him at once. He's like, I want to hear from this guy immediately. He was quickly brought from the prison. And after he shaved and changed his clothes, he went in and stood before Pharaoh. The shaving thing was kind of a big deal. The Egyptians equated hair with bad hygiene. And so they shaved everything. You can use your imagination, but it wasn't just facial hair. He had to be completely prepped to be ready to go into Pharaoh's presence. And so he goes in, Joseph goes in, and he stands before the most powerful king on earth, And Pharaoh said, Joseph, I had this dream. Nobody here can tell me what it means. I've heard that when you hear about a dream, you can interpret it. He lays it all out again. And then we got this another big moment here. Because remember, this is something to think about. Joseph had been in jail for over a decade. Joseph had felt just abandoned and forgotten for over a decade. Again, has he curved inward? What kind of mental state is he in? As he comes into the bright light of Pharaoh's court, he's out of the tank, and he's able to, you know, be in the clean air of, like, you know, normal public life. What kind of state is he in? Well, we find out he's in pretty good shape. He says, Pharaoh, it's beyond my power to interpret your dream, but God, he can tell you what it means, and he can set you at ease. And so after all of this, betrayed by brothers, falsely accused, forgotten, he's still eagerly looking for opportunities to put God in a good light, to give God credit for everything that happens. And so Pharaoh goes ahead, lays his dream out, and then Joseph is ready with the interpretation. He tells them the next 7 years are going to be a period of great prosperity through the land of Egypt. But afterward, there's going to be 7 years of famine so great that all the prosperity will be forgotten. Famine's going to destroy the land. This famine will be so severe that even the memory of the good years will be erased. The bad years are going to cannibalize the good ones, eat them up. That's what that imagery was about. And I'm sure as Joseph laid this out, he had Pharaoh's full attention, because famine in the ancient world was devastating. We know a couple centuries before this, there was a brutal famine, and entire civilizations collapsed because of it. So famine is no joke. And, you know, these words, countless lives are going to be saved, because God gave Joseph insight here into what was about to happen. And so, recognizing the gravity of the situation, Pharaoh, the recommendation that Joseph had would be, why don't you find an intelligent and wise man and put him in charge of the entire land of Egypt? And Pharaoh should appoint supervisors over the land and let them collect a fifth of all crops during the 7 good years. So this is like their how to survive the famine plan. Have them gather all food produced in the good years that are just ahead and bring it to Pharaoh's storehouses, store it away and guard it so that there'll be food in the cities. That way there'll be enough to eat when the 7 years of famine come to the land of Egypt. Otherwise, this famine's going to destroy the land. And so Pharaoh's, you know, and even today, just this, you listen to this, what a totally reasonable way to handle this threat that's coming. Joseph's suggestions, not surprisingly, were well received by Pharaoh and his officials. So Pharaoh asked them, what do you guys think? Can we find anybody else like this Joseph guy who's so obviously filled with the Spirit of God? Who else is going to be able to prepare us for this? And so Pharaoh turns to Joseph. Since God has revealed the meaning of these dreams to you, clearly no one else is as intelligent or wise as you are. Only I, sitting on my throne, will have a rank higher than yours. I hereby put you, Joseph, in charge of the entire land of Egypt. And so at age 30, in a single day, Joseph goes from a prisoner, a forgotten prisoner, to the prime minister of the most powerful empire on earth. And God did it. God did it. Even Pharaoh recognizes God is the one that gave him this insight. It's seeing the hand of God that led Pharaoh to put Joseph in this amazing position of power. Again, I won't hit all the places, but my God, there's so much evidence that God is overseeing affairs, that he's picked Joseph, that he will use Joseph to accomplish his purposes, that nothing's going to get in the way of his goals being met. God's the one that revealed the meaning. He's the one that's driving this all the way through. All right, back in Canaan. Remember the patriarch, Jacob, the old guy, the father of the 12 sons. He's sitting there, and now he's beginning to live through this famine. The famine is hit as predicted. Jacob and his sons here hear that grain is available, and he tells his sons, what are you standing around looking at one another for? I've heard there's grain in Egypt. Go there, buy enough grain to keep us alive, or we're going to die. And so everything that Joseph laid out happened. There were 7 years of famine. Now we're 2 years, into the famine. And fortunately, the grain was stockpiled. Egypt is ready. The whole ancient Near East knows. And so they go down to buy grain. The ten older brothers go down to Egypt, it says. But Jacob would not let Joseph's younger brother Benjamin go, for fear that some harm might come to him. It's been maybe 20 years, and he is still stung by what they did to Joseph. Well, Jacob's sons arrive in Egypt along with others to buy food, and since Joseph was governor now of all Egypt and in charge of selling grain to all the people, it was to him that his brothers came. So they literally roll right up and park themselves in front of Joseph, reunited for the first time in decades. And they bowed before him with their faces to the ground. Just like the dream he had when he was a snot-nosed teenager, it actually came true. They're right in front of him, bowing down to him. Joseph recognized his brothers instantly, but he pretended to be a stranger. He spoke harshly to them. Where are you from? He demanded. From the land of Canaan, they replied. We're here to buy food. And this is interesting. It says, although Joseph recognized them, which makes sense. They were adults when they threw him into the cistern and sold him. He recognized them, but it says they did not recognize him. And that makes a lot of sense. You know, he was a clean-shaven Egyptian now. This is the guy that played Joseph in a TV miniseries a while back. It's actually an excellent miniseries about the life of Joseph. I don't want to use that picture, though, because the dude looks like Prince, and I just can't get past. I just can't picture Joseph that way. So let's go with this, something like that. A lot of reasons why they didn't recognize him. One, he was speaking through a translator. Two, he's wearing the strange attire. They had like guy liner back then. All the men wore makeup. And he's just, what an unexpected position. This like viceroy in Egypt is our brother? He was like completely unrecognizable to them. You could totally see why. Well, Joseph said to them, you're spies. You've come to see how vulnerable our land has become. They shoot back, no, my lord, your servants have simply come to buy food. We're brothers, honest men, we're not spies. Sir, they said, there's actually 12, your servants, all brothers, sons of a man living in Canaan. Our youngest brother is back there with our father right now, and one of our brothers, well, he's no longer with us. How ironic, he was actually right there. And Joseph said, no, you are spies. Now, he knows they're not spies. Why is he messing with them like this? It's because they tried to kill him. It's because of this tension. He was carted away to slavery, and they stared knives at him as he left. He was incarcerated for over a decade because of what they did. He was deeply wounded by these guys. And so, yeah, he's like, I'm gonna get in their heads. He's like, this is how I'm going to test your story. You're not going to leave Egypt unless your youngest brother comes here. One of you has to go get him. I'll keep the rest of you here in prison. Then we'll find out whether or not your story's true. If it turns out that you don't have a younger brother, then I'll know you're spies. I hope for your sake you find him. So that that's pretty firm. And then it says Joseph put him in jail for 3 days. And I wonder if that just, I wonder if he just wanted some time to think. And I also believe that while he was thinking those 3 days, I think God started to work on his heart, soften his heart. You can tell there's a little evidence of softness, because after the third day, interesting comment. Joseph says, you know, I'm a God-fearing man. I've been listening to God lately. If you guys are really honest men, choose one. Remember, he was like, all of you but one are staying. Now he's softened. He says, choose one of your brothers to remain in prison. The rest of you may go home with grain for your starving families. You all, everybody take off. I just want one of you. So you can tell he's softening, but he will not bend on this. When you come back, you better bring your youngest brother. That'll prove that you're telling me the truth and that you will not die. He's like, don't forget to bring him. So speaking among themselves, they have a conference, and they're right there with Joseph, but they think that he doesn't recognize their native tongue, right? And so they speak and they say, oh, well, we're clearly being punished because of what we did to Joseph long ago. We saw his anguish. And he pleaded for his life, and we would not listen. That's why we're in this trouble. Okay, now here's a third thing that really comes across, and you see it all the way through the rest of this story, is Jacob's sons, these 10 older brothers of Joseph, they are riddled with guilt. That image in the audio track of their brother Joseph screaming and pleading for mercy, that was burned in their brain. They haven't been able to forget it. And they have carried the weight of guilt with them for what they did. And it's making them paranoid. This clearly we're being punished. They're afraid of God. They're terrified of Joseph. I mean, they're like just super flipped out all the way through the rest of the story. There's a proverb that says, the wicked run away when no one pursues. You know, Joseph was never a threat to these guys at any point in the story. But they're terrified of because they're guilty and they're paranoid. Well, it says he turned away from them at this point. Joseph's right there with them. Turns his back to him and he starts to weep, and then he just kind of shakes it off, gets his composure. Then he speaks again. Says he chooses Simeon from among them and had him tied up, hogtied, right in front of him. Now, Simeon was likely the one who led the charge to kill Joseph. That's why he ties him up. And right there's a vivid image of what they did to him for 13 years. Just look at Simeon. So you can tell, you know, Joseph seesawing back and forth. Then he orders his servants to fill the men's sacks with grain. He also gave secret instructions to return each brother's payment at the top of his sack. He also gave them supplies for the journey home. And so the brothers loaded their donkeys with the grain, and they headed back to Canaan. On the way back, they stop for the night. One of them opens his sack to get grain for his donkey. He sees money in the top of his sack. There's two ways you could take this. This is like an act of goodwill, or you could take it like someone who's paranoid. This guy says, look, he exclaimed to his brothers, my money's been returned. It's here in my sack. Then their hearts sank. Trembling, they said to each other, what is God doing to us? They just feel like they're being hunted down because they're guilty. And so after they get back to Canaan, you have to put yourself in Jacob's shoes. His sons are back. They're going to give him a report. And this is like the worst news you could possibly get. Here's the report. Simeon's in prison. Yeah, that happened when somehow he wound up in jail. The prime minister of Egypt. No, seriously, the prime minister of Egypt. He thinks we're thieving spies. He does. I know it's rough. He knows about Benjamin. And he's demanding that he come home, or that he come to Egypt. I mean, just, wow. That's a bad report. That's not a trip that went well. And Jacob hits the ceiling. He's like, you're robbing me of my children. Joseph's gone, Simeon's gone, and now you want to take Benjamin? Everything is going against me. Jacob really comes off like just a whiny baby. I'm just like, it's all going against me. It's so terrible. Now let's think about this. Is that true? Is it all going against poor Boo Boo, poor Jacob? Is it really that bad? Absolutely not. In fact, every single statement he makes is false. Joseph's actually doing pretty well. He's alive. Simeon is in the protective care of Jacob's favorite son. And Benjamin, he's not in danger. He's been invited to leave a famine-ravaged region and go and get all the grain he can eat for the rest of his life. None of this is that bad. What's off here is the feelings that Jacob has about how bad things are, about what God is doing, are absolutely wrong. He could not be more wrong. He feels like his two sons and now probably Benjamin have just been abandoned to death by God. But the truth is, God is absolutely in control. They're fine, and his plan is advancing. It's a caution when we think about our own feelings. In the middle of adversity, they are not a reliable way to discern what God is doing. Well, more time passes. The famine continues to ravage the land. When the grain they brought from Egypt was almost gone, Jacob said to his sons, "Go back and buy us a little more food." But Judah said, "Well, that guy was serious when he warned us, 'You won't see my face again unless your brother is with you.' We can't just waltz back to Egypt without Benjamin. If you send Benjamin with us, we'll go down. If you don't, let him go, we won't go. Remember, the guy said, 'You're not going to see me unless you bring him.'" And so they have a big fight. It's a big throwdown, big argument. And finally, Jacob's like, "Okay, we're going to die of the famine anyhow, fine." And so he's like, "May God Almighty give you mercy as you go before the man so that he'll release Simeon and let Benjamin return. But if I have to lose my children, so be it." And so he concedes and lets him go, watches him go down the trail toward Egypt, thinks he'll never see him again. Then it says, when Joseph saw Benjamin with him, he said to the manager of the household, "These men will eat with me this noon. Take them inside the palace. Then go slaughter an animal and prepare a big feast." A big feast? That's an overture. That sounds like someone who's warming up. That sounds like, at least on Joseph's side, the tension's melting, that he wants to do the right thing. But the brothers, they're still guilty. They're still paranoid. They were terrified when they saw that they were being taken into Joseph's house. "It's because of the money someone put in our sacks last time we were here," they said. "He plans to pretend that we stole it. Then he's going to seize us and make us slaves and take our donkeys." And after greeting them, Joseph asked, "How's your father?" So they actually show up to his house. He says, "How's your dad? How's the old man that you spoke about? Is he still alive?" And so he's, again, very warm with them. And they say, "Yeah, our father, your servant, he's alive and well." And they bow low again. Maybe that's why he had those two dreams. And Joseph looked at his brother Benjamin, the son of his own mother. You could tell he really wanted to be reconnected with him. And he says, "Is this your youngest brother, the one you told me about?" Joseph asked, "May God be gracious to you, my son." And just to be reunited with his own blood brother, son of the same mother, just to be able to see him in the flesh, something snapped inside of Joseph. He hurried from the room because he was overcome with emotion for his brother. He went into his private room and he broke down and he wept. Then he had to wash his face and maybe put his eyeliner back on. I don't know. Comes back out, keeps himself under control, and he's like, "Bring out the food." And so they sit down and they eat together, kinda. Remember, the Egyptians really thought hairy shepherds were disgusting. They didn't want the brothers anywhere near their food. And so the brothers sat at their own table as Joseph sat at his own table with his Egyptian staff. They were separate from each other. Well, it says when the brothers were ready to leave, Joseph gave some very interesting instructions to his palace manager. He says, fill each of their sacks with as much grain as they can carry. Put each man's money back into a sack. Then put my personal silver cup at the top of the youngest brother's sack along with the money for his grain. So the manager did as Joseph instructed him. So apparently Joseph had a special sippy cup or some kind of favorite cup. A cup that only he used, and he said, I want you to put that cup in Benjamin's sack. And this is a very carefully crafted test. He was looking for something out of his brothers, and what he was looking for is this. If I implicate Benjamin in a crime, if my brothers are persuaded that he's in dire danger, will they do anything to rescue him? Now, why do you think he was curious to know that? That's because when he was in dire danger, they abandoned him. He's hoping to see something different. And so they all took their sacks. The manager searched. They found the cup in Benjamin's sack. Joseph hears about it, and he says, "What have you done? Don't you know that a man like me can predict the future?" Judah's like, "Oh, what can we say to you? How can we explain this? How can we prove our innocence? God is punishing us for our sins. My Lord, we've returned to be your slaves. All of us, just take all of us, not just our brother who had your cup in his sack." And Joseph is like, no. He's got a very specific test in mind. He's like, only the man who stole the cup will be my slave. The rest of you may go back to your father in peace. This is masterful. Joseph is like, every one of you can walk out of here scot-free, no consequences. All you have to do is abandon Benjamin. That's it. The hook is set, right? This is the test. This is what he wanted to see. And then it says Judah stepped forward. And for the first time in this story, coming from the brothers, we see something really different. We see Judah man up. You just see on the left column how he's owning. We were absolutely sinful in what we did here. But he goes further. Judah says, "My Lord, I can't go back to my father without Benjamin. If he sees that the boy is not with us, he's going to die. So please, my Lord, let me stay here as a slave instead of the boy, and let the boy return with his brothers." Test passed. What we're seeing is Judah, who was one of the people who left Joseph to die, is now ready to give his own life for Benjamin. You know, Joseph just soaked that in, and he looked at Judah, and this is where he completely loses it. Just this goes to the heart of the tension between him and his brothers. It says Joseph couldn't stand it any longer. There were people in the room, and he said to his attendants, "Out, all of you." So he was alone with his brothers. Gets everybody out of the room. He doesn't try to hide it this time. He breaks down and weeps loudly so that the Egyptians, everybody heard about it. And he said, "I'm Joseph. I'm your brother. It's actually me." And you imagine being them, trying to get their brain, like, "You're Joseph." He says, "Look at me." I think it's in verse 4. He's like, "Look at me." He moves close. He's like, "Look." And you can just imagine Joseph's brothers just recognizing his features and realizing, holy crap, it's him. And then really being paranoid and scared, right? Well, he assures them, "Don't be upset. Don't be angry with yourselves for selling me into this place. It was God who sent me here ahead of you to preserve your lives. This famine that's ravaged the land for 2 years, it's going to last 5 more. There's not going to be any plowing or harvesting. God sent me ahead of you to keep you and your families alive, to preserve many survivors. So it was God who sent me here, not you. He is the one who made me an advisor to Pharaoh, the manager of his entire palace, and the governor of all Egypt. Joseph's lived a few years now. He's lived through adversity. And he's stayed faithful to God all the way through. And now, as these events are unfolding, he's starting to get a grip, starting to get the vague outline of what it was God was doing. And it was this. It was God committing to honor that promise to make his people a nation, to protect them from starving in this famine. God, 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 again, all the way through this story. You can read the final stretch here, but I'll just throw out. So the whole fam moves down to Egypt. Pharaoh gives them some great grazing land for their livestock, and they're isolated because the Egyptians want nothing to do with them. Unlike Canaan, where they were influenced by all these really just diabolical belief systems that were trickling into their national way of thinking, in Egypt, they're just there to incubate and to grow into the nation God wanted them to become. And so that's kind of the bulk of this story. I want to think of a few lessons here in the minute I have left. A big lesson is from Joseph. Man, this guy didn't know what was going on for years. He really didn't. He had some vague ideas, but he didn't know what was going on. And he had no family, no high court to appeal to, no guidance from his feelings available, none of that. His comfort came from knowing, hey, there's this promise that God's doing something special with my family that we're part of. And it came from knowing that God, I can just see his hand in my life. I believe that he's working out that bigger plan somehow. I can see evidence of it. I get little glimpses of his hand at work in my life, and I'm going to hold on to those. It was those things that sustained him as he went through this. That's what this emphasis is. The Lord was with me. God sent me before you. It wasn't you. It was God. Why is that repeated? It's because that's the whole point of this story, is that when the people of God, especially in times of adversity, put one foot in front of the other and keep obeying and serving him, trusting that they're participating in this larger purpose that God has, they won't be disappointed. That's really what this whole story is about. You think about us. God's got a role for each person here. That's clearly taught. Not just some generic, you know, telling people about the Lord, trying to be a good person. Ephesians implies it's a custom fit role, that you were built like a master violin maker makes a violin, crafted for a specific purpose in God's overall plan. And it's true, this role is hard to see. Very, very, very hard to see. There's stretches where we go through feeling set aside, feeling like our days of effectiveness are over, not understanding why we would kind of wind up in a cul-de-sac, which just seems like there's nowhere forward. It is difficult. That's most of our life. Most of our life will be this. Most of our life will be characterized by something like this: your word is a lamp to guide my feet. That's what it says in the Psalms. That's what we have. We have God's word showing us a few steps forward. I wish we had a high beam setting, you know, where we could look all the way down, hundreds of yards down, like a good high beams in a car, but we don't. All we have is the word clearly laying out a few steps to take, and the promise that as we do that, we won't be disappointed. Keep taking these clear steps. That's what this whole passage is really, this story is about God's people trusting him to take the clear steps we know he wants us to take, and trusting him with the larger path that he puts us on. Here's my favorite verse on this. It says, I'm suffering here in prison, but I'm not ashamed of it, for I know the one in whom I trust, And I'm sure that he's able to guard what I've entrusted to him until the day of his return. Now, I got a lot of heat from folks when I first decided to go for God. I had, from multiple quarters, people pleading with me not to do it. And man, I have no regrets. I'm so glad that this vision of following God caught my heart early on. And I watching our church go through this leadership change, you know, our founding pastors are—they're around, but they're not leading the whole church anymore. And I've been hanging out with one of them quite a bit. And I wonder, at the very beginning in the early '70s, if they had any clue that our special role would be to reach what people call the acid unchurched, folks that would never darken the doorstep of a church, or that we would be going into countries literally all over the planet, helping different missions groups or sending our own teams in to bring the gospel to people far from here. I wonder if we, you asked our founding pastors who went through hell over the last 40 years, if they ever envisioned at the beginning something like our website and all the lives that it touched. I think if you sat them both down, they would say the bigger purpose that God built me for, you know, it's been 40, 50 years, it's starting to come into focus. And that's the promise. It's not going to be tomorrow. It's not going to be a year from now. But over time, as we take one faithful step in front of the other, that bigger picture will start to come into focus, and we will not be disappointed with our choice to follow God. So, okay, there you go. That is the story. Father, thanks for this workout here. I pray that at least it would whet our appetite to go back through and own these stories for ourselves and to carry these convictions with us. And I really pray, too, for this series coming up, starting in January, Lord. I pray that you would really use our church to be a light in a very polarized culture. And I pray that you would just help us live this life, this love, trust, one step at a time life, where we obey you in faith and leave this larger story to you. I thank you that we won't be disappointed, God. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.